Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture Podcast. And I have another unusual guest, different from our usual farmers and crop breeders and those kind of sort of people. Today we are talking to Fedor from the Frenotopia YouTube channel, a speculative biologist who I discovered through his amazing videos. I strongly recommend you check them out if you're interested in the history and the future of life, not just on Earth, but potentially everywhere. And today we're going to be bouncing around some ideas, mostly focusing on the evolvability and the engineerability of life. What are the limits of what we can do with this amazing substance that we see all around us and we often take for granted? So Fedor, over to you. Give me an introduction about who you are and how you came to be so involved in this particular topic.
Yeah, hi. Yes. Yeah. So my name is Fedor Stamon, and I'm originally from the Netherlands, where I studied biology. And my specialty is actually evolution, systematics, and paleobiology. So it's fossils, especially because I've always been interested in paleontology in general and evolution in general, and the history of life on Earth. And then I eventually moved to Denmark when I was in my 20s. Did some odd jobs and now went and spent some years in the private industry with information technology. And then I went back to the museum world, where I now work at the Natural History Museum of Denmark, but not as a scientist, unfortunately, but as a data coordinator. So I'm working with the data of the collections there. And in my spare time, I still like to dabble in the topic of evolution, and especially evolution of life on other planets, which is what I started, the topics of my YouTube channel started centering about those topics. And I'm really enjoying it. Yeah, I really like to think, I want to solve this puzzle, even if it's just on my own. I want to solve the puzzle of what will life be like on another planet.
Does your position, kind of on the edge of that professional research world, give you more freedom to do this kind of self-directed exploration?
I mean, I cannot really do it as part of my job, but I do have a network, you might say, and I have a lot of scientists, colleagues around me. We get along really well, all of us, and there's a lot of inspiration from just my work and even just doing the work that I'm doing, which I this is my dream job, because I've always both been interested in biology and evolution, and also been interested in including museums, right? Natural history museums, but also interested in computers. So I'm kind of combining those things together. And I'm still embedded in that world. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, color me jealous. I'm just a history of science. Like, I look at the work that was done by the independent gentleman scientists of the 19th century, where they were free to basically do whatever drove their interest and show off to their friends. That was part of it as well. But compare that to the transformation into the post-World War kind of institutionalized bureaucratic scientific system, which I think is a lot less bold. It's a lot less imaginative. It has different pressures that it puts on the people working in professional science. And I wonder if there's a whole lot of low-hanging fruit that is still within reach of enthusiastic amateurs. I wouldn't even say amateur, just people who aren't in the profession have opportunities that perhaps have been overlooked. So yeah, you're my kind of person.
Thank you. Yeah.
I want to highlight the one video from your channel that really stood out to me on the origin of animal body plans. Can you talk that up a little bit to get people to go and check it out?
Oh yeah. So that is my latest video. It's one of my series of deep evolution dives, but I kind of link it to my main series about alien biosphere evolution, because it's so overlapping. And I mean, my focus here is trying to figure out, okay, how did we get animals? Animals are something very peculiar when you think about it. If you compare it with the bulk of life, or life as we had it on Earth, it's mostly protists, especially bacteria, of course, and then especially plants, algae, and then plants and fungi. With regards to biomass, they make out the bulk of life on Earth. And animal seems to be kind of, you know, seems to be this extra cream on our biosphere, so to speak. It's these very specific, very active agents that eventually led to something like us, which clearly has the capabilities to affect our biosphere enormously, dangerously, as we all know. So how did we get there? How did we just get started on that path towards animals? How did we get from a clump of cells to humans? And like I start out in this particular video that you mentioned, I mean, an animal is more than, even the simplest conceivable animal is more than just a clump of cells. It's a clump of cells that has learned to cooperate. And then it has learned to pattern itself in specific ways to form this very compartmentalized functional complex of different functions. And how it's just increasingly becomes like a nested set of different compartments and organs, and you know, starting with just tissues grouped into organs, grouped into compartments, it comes to this functional whole, and it's almost fractal how it starts to, you know, becomes like an ever branching pattern of ever more complicated interactions. How did it start?
What I really loved was the exploration of how changing embryonic body forms led to major advances from one phylum to another, from like sponges to jellyfish to flatworms and then beyond. And it really reminded me of learning that sea squirts, those little baggy creatures stuck on the bottom of rocks at the beach with the two little tubes sticking out of them, that they're the ancestors of all of the vertebrates. And they became us through their larvae, for sea squirts are these little tadpole-like creatures that allow them to swim to another rock before they settle down and transform. And when you see a fish, that's basically a tunicate larvae that just never settled down. And that just gave me a wonderful idea for a sci-fi story. If you could figure out how to induce those ancient dormant genes in humans, they could transform into like a beanbag creature with like two holes in it that just lays there and filter feeds.
Oh, yeah. that could be a few. I mean, we're basically evolving to that anyway, right? We're sitting behind our computers all day long. So we might just as well be sessile completely. So yeah, that's...
It also made me realize that higher vertebrates might have lost the ability to change their deep body plan, because our embryos, there's not very many of them, and we keep them so protected from selective pressure compared to sea creatures, where they just, you know, their little embryos are floating around in the ocean and they have to fend for themselves. So do you have any thoughts on that idea, that the deep evolution is going to have to come from elsewhere in the tree of life?
Well, I have several ideas, but and everything, when I'm thinking about these issues, I always try to root it in the immediate environment that the creature has to survive in, right? You cannot just, evolution is not teleological. It doesn't think ahead. It doesn't think about, wouldn't it be nice to be a fish swimming in the sea? No, you know, you're a worm, so you have to survive as a worm somehow. And anything added to that lifestyle is maybe a slight bonus, and then it starts to expand out into that. So what you often see is that in order to become a bigger organism, right, because your clump of cells, a single cell can keep itself afloat in the water column. A clump of cells, you know, can also do that. But a certain moment you reach a certain size above which it becomes too hard for just simple flagella, you know, these little sweeping hairs that single cells have, like even our sperm cells still have, it becomes too, they're not going to be strong enough to keep the creature afloat. So you're going to have to be living on the sea bottom somehow, to try to even living out of there. But then you would still want to be able to spread your life form otherwise. So you might want to have a larval stage that is free swimming. And then depending on circumstances, maybe you see this also in a lot of plants, right? They have different ways of spreading their seeds. And you had the same for animals, early animals. Do you want to, even if they're big and sessile, like sponges or, you know, corals, for instance, you'd still want to spread around. So you want to keep this swimming stage when you're still small. And then if you want to get better at spreading yourself, then your larvae starts to evolve. Your larvae start to evolve more than the adult stage is evolving, right? Because a sponge is just a clump of cells, basically, that builds like a whole structure to keep itself together and create this maze of tunnels to filter food through. But it's in itself, it's a relatively simple thing. It's basically just a clump of protists hanging together, building these skyscrapers from their perspective. So where you can get innovation is actually in the larval stage. In any case, for marine animals at this stage. So the larval stage, you can specialize. And then what we apparently see this repetition. So you got this very advanced larva that can swim further and further, spread the animal, into new areas. And then at certain moment, the you get what's called the truncation. There are several terms you can attach to this. There's something called neoteny or pedimorphosis, meaning that the larval or the juvenile stage becomes, attains maturity. In other words, it can reproduce itself. You don't need to become a big adult. So then when the larvae start to become, able to fend for themselves, including reproducing themselves, you basically get a new animal.
Mm-hmm.
And then that animal will, specialize itself again. So what we think is what happened is that, sponge larvae, they're still basically a clump of cells. But what we think happened is this became more specialized. So the cells started to form membranes. So basically just a ball filled with mesogly, which is kind of a suspension of proteins to give it a certain gel-like firmness.
Some of the proteins they use for sticking cells together in an animal derive from proteins used for sticking to rocks.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of repurposing going on, and it's amazing how much precursors for that we now use for multicellular animals. They're already there even in the protist phase, because protists often multicellular animals have different cell types. And when you think of a protist, you just think of this as just a single cell. So you cannot have different cell types. But actually, the protist also goes through different stages. One stage might be more amoeba-like. Another stage would be with a little swimming tail. And there's a stage that, it comes encapsulates itself. So, and you can actually repurpose all those different cell phases, become cell types if you put a lot of different cells together.
Yeah.
So some cells start to become swimming, others start to specialize in digestion or maybe move inside. So to be kind of, like an amoeba-like form that builds the internal skeleton. I mean, this happens in sponges, right? Some cells, the spicule, the whole structure that sponges use to keep themselves together, they're actually formed by these amoeba-like stages of their cells. They just move around, form these spicules. And then, the rest of the cells keep their little sweeping hairs, their little flagella, to move water around inside the whole structure. So, yeah, this is also another aspect that's really fascinating. And there's things evolve for a certain reason in a simple life form. And then those things apparently can then be repurposed for a more, complex organism.
Mm.
And the same with the larvae.
Now, you mentioned something interesting about the past evolutionary history. Basically, every step along the way needs to survive, like it's under constant natural selection.
Yeah.
But and that prevents it from like planning ahead and intending to like reach a destination, like maybe via some steps that aren't so viable.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that's a potential role for humans to play in the future of evolution, because we are capable of that planning and that intention and helping life forms through stages that may not be instantly competitive in an open ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at all the crazy things we've done with selective breeding ornamental plants and like fancy animals that can like barely stand up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you would never see that in nature, right?
Mm.
A lot of these animals, they would not survive in nature, but we can make them because we can take away the natural selection and let artificial selection take over. But yeah, I didn't even touch on the whole, conservation through constraints. Constraints are also this very important subject here.
Which we
And
will tap on. We'll touch on them. It's on my list.
yes, okay. We could talk about it later, right? But it's I have several examples to underline how simple choices made in the early evolution have a huge effect later on in the branch.
I have one other wild question to throw at you.
Yeah.
So when you look at multicellularity, plants and animals are descended from particular kinds of protozoans, protists. And but there's so many other protists that never quite made the transition. Like some algae kind of half did it. Fungi went a little bit
Yeah.
further. Slime molds, when they're in the mood, they'll be multicellular.
Yes.
But it made me wonder if humans could help other protists become fully multicellular. Perhaps they're unable to do it in the open environment because plants and animals have already taken all of those niches. So there's no pressure for them to do it again. But I
Yeah.
wonder if there's like whole new kingdoms of multicellular life that could be created with human involvement.
Yes. That would be interesting to think about, but we need to understand multicellularity very well before we can start to meddle with it. I was just about a new paper just came out that I just still need to read, but it's about the brown algae, how they became multicellular. And there seem to be some similarities to how animals became multicellular. In any case, there's this ontogeny, this developmental tract, so to speak, there are some parallels there in the sense that there's the so-called hourglass model of ontogeny. So meaning that, you might have a lot of variation in the initial stages of ontogeny when, the fertilized cell starts developing, but it always converges to a kind of a phylotypic stage, meaning that this is where we really can see, okay, this is the same for all other multicellular animals that derive from this common ancestor. And then you see the same in brown algae, apparently. So what another thing, because I want to start, I mean, I've been not spending enough time on my channel thinking about more concretely about life on other planets, but I really want to solve this one big puzzle, is how will we be able to distinguish plants and animals and fungi on another planet? Or is that something very provincial? Because the reason that plants and fungi became multicellular in the way that they did and not turn into little animals in their own right? I mean, you could have like a free moving with a legged plant in principle that just moved around on land to find a better spot to photosynthesize. But you didn't get that. Plants are very stationary. And that is also a constraint that plays a role there, because plants and fungi, they both have cell walls, which animals particularly have not. Animals do not have cell walls, they only have cell membranes. So this is already a constraint for plants, for the ancestors of the protist ancestors of plants and of fungi. So could we engineer plants? I mean, could we change a plant into something more animal-like, which might be, could be if you got like crops that can move around in the field to find the most optimal spots to grow, right? That would be advantageous, right? But you will have these biophysical constraints about how plant bodies work, right?
It goes all the way down to the cellular
Yeah.
level, like what you can get
So,
away with.
yeah. So, I mean, you cannot just graft animal legs on a plant, right? The cells are very different, the hormones are very different, the interactions are very different. You need to change a lot of things just on the biomolecular and genetic level. But then you also need to change a lot on the biophysical level.
Well, that's probably a good place to transition into
Yeah.
talking about like what are the limits to the evolution of life. We'll get back to talking about extraterrestrial life towards the
Yeah.
end. I'll make a note on
Yes.
that. What's a really good example I think of is this, as a mythical creature that you just take a horse and you just sew a couple of giant wings onto it and you're like, oh, that'll be able to fly. But
Of
there's
course.
so many reasons why that wouldn't work. Not just because like the embryology only gives you four limbs to play around with. Mm-hmm. Though, I mean, that's, if you dig deep enough, you can start tinkering with those
sure.
elements. You can add limbs, but more energetically, like horse lungs cannot breathe in oxygen efficiently enough to get an animal that heavy off the ground in our atmosphere. If you had a thicker atmosphere, maybe, but.
Well, yes, you need to fundamentally change the horse anatomy to be able to do that. But we had animals in the air that were much bigger than horses. You know, you had animals that were biggest giraffes up in the air, like, you know, Quetzalcoatlus, which is kind of a pterosaur. And the way, but they slowly evolved into that state, right, where they have these very light skeletons. They probably have, I'm not really sure about pterosaurs though, but dinosaurs, including birds, have also a lot of air sacs that go throughout their body. And which also make, because, you know, if 10% or 20% of your body is made of air, then of course you'll be lighter, right?
Yeah.
So we had animals that could fly that were the size of giraffes, but they were probably much lighter than giraffes because they were built differently.
Yeah.
So in principle,
I saw a really interesting biophysical study on what limits the upper size of birds. And the problem is that they need to periodically regrow their flight feathers. And those feathers have to scale with the size of the bird in order to be aerodynamic. And beyond a certain point, the birds actually can't grow the feathers quickly enough to replace them to maintain functioning wings. So that's one of the peculiar reasons why there are some very large flighted birds in the recent evolutionary past that are gone now, but they never got anywhere as near as big as the pterodactyls and the pterosaurs before them that had those membrane wings that didn't have the same problem.
That is very interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah, because the membrane wings, like in bats and pterosaurs, you know, they would in that case be more advantageous. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that's the thing in life. It's all about trade-offs, isn't it? Like you can try and improve one thing, but it comes at a cost, and you have to be able to pay that cost in the ecosystem in order to get away with it.
Yeah. I mean, my favorite example are the arthropods, right? They have this amazing exoskeleton, which really contributed to their success. It's because it can be specialized, you know, all these little parts of their body, their segmented body, you know, combined with the exoskeleton, gives a lot of, you know, opens up for a lot of innovation, which we also see in evolution. It's actually so innovative that it's very hard to keep track of exactly now what happens, you know, because all the lineages are experimenting in their own different ways and sometimes in very parallel ways. And you have to sort out, is this convergence or is this, you know, derived trait? Is this homologous? I mean, the way they use their different appendages, right? But they're also very much constrained, especially in size and especially on land. Because the reason why we briefly had some giant arthropods in the, I think it was Carboniferous period on land.
I want to ride one of those giant millipedes.
Yeah, exactly. I think Arthropleura is one of those in genera. And yeah, that would be awesome. But I wonder if they were probably relatively slow, I think. I'm not sure they're going to be really fast-paced predators. I think they were just detritivores or eating plant materials. There's like the modern-day millipedes still do, right? But in tiny form. But the oxygen levels were also very high back then, probably because of this is the first time for land life to evolve. And so you had all this plant growth, but you didn't yet have the fungi to break down the plant material. So a lot of the carbon just got sequestered into deposits of plant material, which eventually turned into coal deposits, which is why we can now, you know, mine all this coal. Most of the coal is from that era, is from the Carboniferous. And So the fungi ability to be able to break down the lignin, you know,
the wood
material in a lot of these bigger plants, they evolved later. So all these things kind of develop at the same time. And there are all these factors that play a role. So in the beginning, I think that's one of the reasons. And I'm going a bit out on a limb there, but I think that's one of the reasons why you had such high oxidant levels back then, which enabled bigger arthropods because of the way their breathing system works. They use trachea, which are these tiny little tubes that go through the body, but you will get this diffusion constraint because there's a limit to how far you can exchange gases over a certain distance. In this way, our lungs are much more, you know, advantageous because we have this circulatory system with our blood vessels. We've got lungs that oxygenate the blood, and then the blood is distributed through, you know, with a pump and dissolved in water, right?
I actually wondered, bound
to the blood cells. Yeah.
If you really did Jurassic Park, would the dinosaurs all be laying around, like struggling to breathe because they need higher oxygen levels?
Yeah, I think also oxygen levels were higher in the Mesozoic compared to nowadays, right? So I think a lot of dinosaurs would have problems.
They'd be in wheelchairs with oxygen masks on them.
Yeah, exactly. So it would be cool. Would be cool to engineer an animal, maybe even a dinosaur, like, or an animal as big as a dinosaur, but maybe it would not survive in our current, you know, atmosphere. So you have those limits as well. Now,
doesn't that pattern go right back to the start of multicellular animals, that they seem to have emerged when oxygen first started to rise?
Well, yeah, even, you know, the abiogenesis, right? The first life that evolved on Earth, the atmosphere was completely different. There was no free oxygen. Mm. It's assumed to be a very reductive atmosphere. So this is one of the reasons why you probably will not, well, the main reason you will not get another abiogenesis is it will probably be consumed right away with all the life that is around already.
Yep. Yep.
But another reason might be that you might need these very reductive circumstances for, you know, the first life to rise from prebiotic chemistry. And then again, you need a certain kind of set of circumstances to create multicellular life. That is a good question. They have done some experiments on coanoflagellates, which are these protists that are, you know, most closely related to animals. And they could kind of induce them to become more multicellular in the sense that they could induce them to create bigger clumps of aggregates or cells. Mm-hmm. So you might still get a shot at another form of multicellular life given enough time, even if under our circumstances. And, you know, maybe even a Cambrian explosion, right? If all macro life is, you know, is, or even all multicellular life is, you know, died off for some reason, maybe you only got bacteria or protists left, then with our current, if the oxygen levels stay the way they are, you would probably get another Cambrian explosion.
Yeah.
Because, yeah.
Oh, don't tempt me. Don't tempt me. I've got my finger hovering over the big red
button. Oh,
no. As long as I'm around to watch it. I want to watch it.
This would be, this would be something for a mad scientist to try.
But there were other transitions in evolutionary history that seemed to have relied on changes in the atmosphere or ocean chemistry, like the emergence of shells and exoskeletons, I think was linked to, correct me if I'm wrong, it wasn't just oxygen levels, but that was around the time that the first mosses moved onto the land and they triggered a massive mobilization of calcium into the ocean. Mm-hmm. That wasn't there before. I might be wrong with that. But,
Well, it has to do with oxygen levels in any case. Mm. That is also my leaning.
I think it had to do with maybe both.
And my understanding was that it had to do with increased erosion of the continental shelves.
Yeah.
There was like a rise in sea levels that then drew more minerals down into the water. I mean, it was probably a whole complex of factors. I mean, it might have been associated with some early form of plants or photosynthesizing land life. When you say mosses, I'm not sure if you mean like actual mosses or maybe lichens.
Lichens or liverworts, it could have been, if I've got my timing wrong.
Lichens.
But the main point I'm trying to make for people who aren't in this area, evolution isn't just waiting for the right amount of mutations to accumulate and then suddenly a new form is viable. Often it's like life is kind of pushed up against a physical ecological barrier that the chemistry of the environment isn't quite right to allow something to happen. And once you cross that threshold, lots of different groups all try that experiment around about the same time.
Yes, I have the same impression. It's often presented in a way that, you know, when you watch these documentaries, it says, oh, and then this and that creature then suddenly had a mutation and that enabled it to do this and that. Whereas it looks more like it's these mutations happen all the time. It's like there's like this background noise of mutations. But as long as the circumstances aren't right, then nothing will happen with that supposed innovation, because it's not really an innovation if you can't really use it in the environment.
And
but
it means
also
that the whole
gives hope.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. It means that the whole biosphere is evolving as well as a geochemical entity. And it's interacting in a feedback loop with all of the genomes of all of the species that are hanging out here.
Yeah, that is Lovejoy's Gaia theory, right? It's still a bit current, but it does look like it's this whole system, that interact with each other.
And taking that somewhere more maybe controversial, the recent evolutionary history featured a prolonged period of unusually low carbon dioxide levels compared to, you know, the hundreds of millions of years of complex life beforehand. And some people have hypothesized that that may have been a key ingredient for the emergence of humans, of this very strange life form that has a bunch of tricks that nothing has ever quite managed to pull off before. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I do have thoughts on how humans emerge from apes, but I'm not sure how that links back to the carbon dioxide levels. What I have always, for a long time, have understood to be the trigger for human evolution is that, you know, you had apes. Apes are very predominant during a certain time of the Cenozoicum, which is the age of the mammals. Mm-hmm. I think especially around the Miocene, you had a lot of diversity of apes. As you know, you had a lot of monkeys as well, but apes, they were quite widespread all over the world. Mm-hmm. But none of them evolved into humans, right? So, but then something happened in Africa, and the prevailing theory is still, and this theory is, I think it's about 20, 30 years old, is that the Great Rift Valley, actually, which is just a geological fluke, right? All of a sudden, part of Africa started to, you know, move away to the east, to basically start to create a new little continent. Part of Africa is ripping itself apart over the Great Rift Valley. If you wait long enough, that will, you know, drift into the ocean, into the Indian Ocean, and become its own little landmass. But before that happens, you get this different environment. It kind of started splitting up the biomes, and you used to have like this transcontinental rainforest that went across the equator. And during, I think it was the Pliocene, the Great Rift Valley actually cut off part of that forest to the east. And then that forest started drying up. So it became more and more savanna-like. And the apes that were caught in that part of the forest, of the African rainforest, they were forced to adapt to very different circumstances, being the more savanna-like biome. And it is thought that that's kind of spurred or spurred bipedality, and also being more resourceful with regards to, you know, exploring the environment, maybe also, you know, need to walk further. Of course, in a rainforest, the resources are very concentrated, right? You can just, you know, stay in one area and then move to another area. It's a very rich environment. A savanna environment, it's, you know, your resources are more spread out. You need to walk further distances. You need to be able to carry stuff from one place to another. And another reason is that you get the solar irradiation becomes a factor, especially at the equator. So you need to kind of adapt to surviving outside of the rainforest, you know, outside of the cover of trees. So what probably happened is that we start losing our fur, we start sweating more, and the fur on our head remained or actually became more frizzy to act as a shield for the sun, because that is, if you stand upright, This is actually very advantageous compared to an animal that is bi- that is not that works on four legs, because its whole back will, you know, be will
exposed.
Exposed to the sun. But if you stand upright, you actually, especially at the equator, you have kind of this, you could create this shield. Only the top of your head is exposed to the sun. So all of these factors contributed to morphing these primitive, of these, well, I wouldn't say primitive, these early apes to become more and more human-like. Then if you add to that, that humans started hunting more actively. So we started developing this marathon physiology. Because, it, you know, we tend to kind of talk down on our physiology, right? You think, oh, we're just so average. We cannot run fast. We cannot fly. We don't have strong muscles. But actually, very, very, humans are very lean and very specialized in surviving, especially in an environment as, like the savannah, to walk, to run after a prey for a prolonged amount of time without, you know, getting overheated. And that,
that
is
actually...
still...
That reminds me of, I love asking this question to people, which human feature is our most unique feature compared to all other animals?
Yeah.
And the obvious answer is our brain. And it's actually, it's big, but it's structurally not that interesting. I mean, it's got a few cellular things that seem to be advantageous at a change. But if you look
at it, it's
mostly an oversized monkey brain.
Yeah.
But yeah, which part of the human body is the most unique? Can you guess?
Oh, well, I would say our running body. We're like, I cannot think of any animal that is, apart from being bipedal,
it's the foot. If you look at a monkey foot, if you look at a monkey foot and a human foot, it's been so transformed that it's almost unrecognizable. But this brings up the really interesting idea of pleiotropy. So this is when you, because of the way bodies are built from reusing a limited set of genes, there's a limit to how much you can change one part of the body without it changing another part. And there's some really interesting examples of this. Like East Asians have a single mutation that causes fewer sweat glands, thicker hair, and smaller breasts, all just from one gene, because that one gene gets used in multiple places for different systems. So with humans, when we underwent all of that evolution around our feet, they think that it also disrupted the genes for our hands. And that's probably where we got our opposable thumbs at the same time, because there was just so much happening at the end of our limb gene instructions. And it also means that you can't independently evolve the foot without having some effect on the hand, because they reuse the same basic building blocks.
Yeah, that's a very interesting theory. I wasn't aware of that particular one, but I was aware of systemic changes, right? And one thing either affecting the other or being repurposed in another part of the body. Also, I've also read a theory, I forgot the name of the book. I think it was from Man to Animal, I'm not sure, but someone who was specializing was really fascinated by animal intelligence and also language. And he had a theory that the dexterity of our fingers and hands parallels the dexterity of our speech system.
Ah, yes. And the conscious connection with it.
Yeah, exactly. So the part of our brain, the motoric part of motoric system, right? That is evolved in becoming better and better with our hands, kind of also enabled us to become better and better at manipulating sounds manipulating air with our throats and mouths, right? It's either manipulating objects or manipulating the outflow of air, which is language. This is how we can speak. We're actively doing very complex things with our mouths and throats to generate different sounds and have an ever more complex system of communication. So I'm also fascinated about how things as systemically positively affect each other, right? It's not just, you change one part of the body and that's just provincial, it's just local for that part. No, it becomes like a whole system and it could,
I like to think of an animal's body a bit like an iPhone, that like you can put a bigger camera in it, but then the battery has to get smaller. Like there's trade-offs. In, yeah. Like you can only fit so much in. And if you look at a whole human body compared to other animals, we consume about the same amount of energy per kilogram of tissue as anything else. And the way we can afford this huge energy hogging brain is that we've made our muscles weaker and we've made our digestive system smaller, but we've had to use our brain to compensate for those weaknesses compared to other animals.
Yes. Yes. And this is why it's so annoying. They always have to go up to the gym, right? Because our body is so good. It's, you know, oh, you're not using your muscles. Well, let's get rid of those then. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, it takes so much effort to keep a fit body, and, you know, apes, they can just lie around all day almost. And they're like bodybuilders compared to us.
Well, I think there's actually a mutation in a muscle development protein in human evolution that basically just turned our muscles off. And it means we can, if you've got a very hot running metabolism, you're more likely to either overheat or to starve if the ecosystem turns against you.
Yeah. And another associated innovation is actually we got more white fat tissue than brown fat, which helps us kind of, when there is plenty, we can really stock up a lot of energy in that fat tissue, which also makes us less, you know, athletic compared to our ape relatives. Mm-hmm. But, you know, yeah.
While we're on human evolution, do you have any thoughts about what was the key change that happened, you know, 50 odd thousand years ago to give one particular group of hominins a leg up on all of the competition?
Well, no, I don't. I mean, you'd have to go much further away. I think you have to go all the way, I mean, million or maybe several million years ago to Homo erectus. I think Homo erectus or Homo ergaster, that grade of hominins, was what made a difference.
Yeah.
Because before that, we were still kind of apes. There was this whole branching of different lineages of apes trying to survive in savanna environments, and yet the paranthropines that tried to, you know, that grew these huge jaws and teeth, you know, molars, and these apparently they had like a crest on their head for chewing, so they were kind of more becoming more a vegetarian diet, or, you know, tubers and things like that to dug up from the ground, probably, presumably. But we started out, well, actually we started hunting. I mean, I don't want to offend any vegans or vegetarians, but the reason that we started to rely more on animal products, especially through hunting, is probably what enabled us to become these big brained animals. So I think that shift, combined with our intelligence and the relative, you know, adaptability of our body, that made a big difference. But that this goes way back. And once we became humans, I think when you look at Homo erectus, you can basically see a modern human just with a smaller brain, right?
Everything that Homo sapiens did 50,000 years ago, Homo erectus did it a million years earlier.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, I don't think there was something specifically different about hominins, or I mean Homo sapiens 50,000 or even 100,000 years ago, that made a difference. I mean, there were some divergence, right? There were the Neanderthals that were apparently, you know, specialized in surviving in the cold north during you know, a period where there were a lot of ice ages, and they, I mean, in a cold environment, you would even need more energy. So it kind of makes sense that they were specialized in hunting, you know, megafauna, which we think they did. And their brains were quite large, actually. But you seem to get stuck in that lifestyle, because when we arrived, we basically, I mean, there were some interbreeding, right? But Homo sapiens, our body plan, basically took over from the Neanderthals in the northern continents. So there's that edge, you could say, you know, but I think that's also a lesson. If you become too specialized, you, especially maybe even as humans or as hominins, you kind of, you're on a dead end, like the paranthropines that were the sister lineage to, you know, the Australopithecines that led to humans. They started to rely more on, you know, probably eating vegetable material, tubers and stuff like that. they went extinct eventually, and what we were left with were the hominins. Yeah. So I hope this answers your question.
No, well, I did see a really interesting study on, we're starting to get enough Neanderthal genomes now that we can do population genetics. Mm. And it looks like the Neanderthals were in very isolated, small inbred communities that seem to have very little gene exchange with their neighbors. Where if you look at Homo sapiens, we seem to have this culture of getting along with our neighbors well enough that we can regularly swap young people of like marrying age. And I almost look at Homo sapiens as being like a super organism for that reason, that there's a genetic connection from like South Africa all the way to Siberia. And we're regularly exchanging genes in a way that, and it, maybe it comes down to being predatory, that because we've become so dangerous to members of our own species, that it took us a while to figure out how to safely negotiate those relations with groups that we weren't as familiar with, that we only saw occasionally?
Well, that's a good question, because the more lethal we came, the more peaceful we needed to become, right? The, the more diplomatic we needed to become. Yeah, I like that theory. What I would like to add to the genetic, the gene exchange, is also the exchange of knowledge. I mean, the Neanderthals, they were like more spread out, more isolated, and that also prevented an exchange of knowledge. And you know, as when we look back at history and how different peoples, you know, developed in different parts of the world, it is that the exchange of knowledge is really paramount to how far those societies progress. I mean, you're in Australia, right? There were the Aboriginals. I mean, they're exactly, I mean, the same as us. They're not inferior in any way, even though, you know, we used to believe that back in the days, right? But they're exactly like us. They have the same genes, the same intelligence, in the same brains, you know. But their society kind of got stuck. I mean, it's often a bit underrated, because it turns out that the original peoples, they were actually very good at, they were much better at, you know, exploiting the environment than we give them credit for. They had this whole kind of agricultural system where they were in tune with, you know, the moving of the seasons and all of that. That is very under, there's not a lot of focus on how well the Aboriginals were doing before, you know, Europeans arrived. But at the same time, they were more spread out. There was a more, the exchange of information was more limited. So the theory is that that probably caused them not to develop as quickly as people on northern continents. Now, we all know about the Gun, Germs, and Steel book. Probably most of us have heard about that. Jared Diamond, who wrote that, he proposed that because of the northern continents, they were laid out in this fashion that you had the whole, you had the same biomes that allowed for the spread of ideas much more easily, because people's moving through those biomes, they didn't have to adapt to a new kind of environment all the time. They could just adapt to grasslands and forests, right?
And they weren't major barriers like oceans between them and the rest of the world.
It was relatively flat. So this probably contributed to developments, you know, being so quick on both the East Asian and the West, you know, European, and also the South Asian civilizations and societies. So there was a, but then again, it's also become a bit discredited, right? Because he said, no, because the American continents were laid out differently. So this is why you didn't get this much exchange of knowledge. But you did have these, you know, Central American and Southern American civilizations. So there was potential for society building. But then there was not a lot of cross-pollination between the Incas and the Aztecs, for instance, right? So
yeah, that Darien gap down through that little tiny isthmus of horrible rainforest is not the easiest thing to travel through.
Exactly. So there's the exchange of genes, and there's also the exchange of knowledge, which is basically making the humanity like a super brain, which we're especially seeing now with our modern society, with internet and everything. We're really, you know, but I'm more prefer to think rather than internet, I think more of the scientific progress. There's a lot of, you know, scientific progress being made by the exchange of ideas by scientists all over the world, right? And that is really kind of,
That brings up an idea that the mechanisms for evolution are themselves evolving over time. An example I really love to point to is when insects started pollinating flowers, it triggered this massive explosion in diversity of the plants because now they had all these other mechanisms for more rapid evolution, for keeping species separate. And I wonder if humanity might end up serving a similar role for the biosphere, of functioning as a kind of cross-pollinator, either through like low-tech methods like selective breeding and just moving things around, or higher-tech approaches like, well, we've got CRISPR now. And do you have any thoughts about that? And we're kind of moving on to talking about the limits of that very high-tech way of trying to manipulate life.
I mean, CRISPR is basically derived from how our bodies or how our cells actually battle viruses, right? And it is interestingly linked to the horizontal gene transfer that we know has happened in the evolution of life on Earth. But it's focusing a lot on the genome. And I think, I mean, if you want to change a creature, of course, you need to look at the genome, right? There's a lot of information there. The basic information for any organism is in the DNA. And the more you understand how that works, the better you become at manipulating that. So what are the limits? That's actually a very good question. I think that the limit is that it's only limited to the genetic basis of an organism. And I think there might be more going on than just genetics. I mean, there's a lot of talk about epigenetics, which is, of course, a thing in itself, but
It's
it's
kind of like a
increasingly.
dozen different things that we know about. Like there's all these different mechanisms that keep popping up for epigenetic interactions, and it just
Yes, a
gets
maternal
messier and
effect.
messier.
Yeah, and there's the maternal effect. I mean, they're trying to revive things like the thylacine and mammoth, and it's going to be interesting how well they're going to, you know, what's going to how that's going to turn out, right? Because what we don't have anymore is the original creature that created the original womb that let that that these creatures developed in, right?
Yeah,
We don't have,
the
I mean,
DNA alone might not be
yeah,
enough.
exactly. The maternal effects, some other effects that we don't have knowledge of, that might be the limiting factors. There's a lot going on in cells that we're just scratching the surface, right?
There's a lot of immune system training that happens in mammals as well between the mother and the offspring.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. And some of the genetic material of the infant, of the fetus, developing fetus, ends up in the mother even. So some mothers become kind of this mosaic, genetically mosaics, right? I mean, to a limited degree, but there's a lot of things going on between the mother and the fetus.
To extend that idea further, if you imagine like humanity got wiped out and then our robots
Oh yeah.
took genomes and remade humans, but we
Exactly.
wouldn't really be humans as we know ourselves today because all of the culture and the information that we exchange culturally would be potentially gone and would need to be like recreated
Yes.
somehow, but it would never be quite the same.
Just the culture, right? But even, you know, what is lost by just taking the genome. I think I heard the news the other day that they can now encode the entire human genome in these kind of cubes, or these very hardy crystal cubes that can survive all kinds of extreme conditions. So basically our genome can survive till the end of the universe, right? So we can always recreate humans based on their genome. But then I wonder, are we not maybe missing out on something? I mean, the way we get a human is not by just taking the DNA strand and then building something on top of that. The DNA strand is inside a cell, and the ovum has all this molecular machinery around it, which in itself also has a lot of memory, right? And we might, I mean, this is a bit, I wouldn't say controversial, but there might be more going on the cytoplasm level than we realize. It's not just the genes that hold the information. There might be information encoded, maybe even in, you know, something like microtubules, which are these long strands in each cell, that are used as, you know, as a cytoskeleton, kind of holding the structure of the cell, and also serving as conduits for different processes, like, you know, moving around of materials. And also they're also involved in pulling apart the chromosomes during meiosis and mitosis. So there's a lot of information processing going on just with those protein products. Now, those are products, of course, of the genome, but their information might not come directly from the genome. They might be transferred from the cell through the whole cell lineage that led to the ovum that then becomes fertilized into a, you know.
Can you imagine if one of those genomes in an indestructible cube like fell to Earth from space and it had this sequence on it that we'd never seen before? And it's like, do we make it? What's it going to grow into?
Oh, yeah. There are many movies around that. You know, it's a movie called, from the 90s called Species. That's exactly that.
There you go. Oh, yeah. It's a radio species. Signal they pick up that's a genome.
Yeah. It's a genome. Yeah. So like, okay, let's throw it into an organism, see what happens.
Terror
disastrous consequences.
Yeah, of course. Issues. Well, it wouldn't be a movie if there wasn't a disaster at the end.
Exactly.
Yeah. I wonder too if the current excitement and focus on DNA and genomics is a little bit like that saying that if a drunk person like loses their keys at night, they'll end up looking under the lamppost because that's where the light is. And the keys are probably somewhere else, but there's no point looking there because they couldn't even see them if they tried. And I wonder if our modern, because like genomics has exploded onto the scene, you know, within my lifetime. And I wonder if at some point we're going to be like, maybe we've done as much as we can with this aspect of biology.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know a lot about genomics. It's never been the focus of my... I mean, I know about how DNA works and genetics, but my focus is not so much on population genetics, on genetics itself. And so it's relatively new to me as well. So yeah, but maybe you can fill me in a little bit and give me something to respond to.
Well, I look at biotechnology as having a really ancient past, and like the foundations of our civilization are biotechnological. They're organisms that for the vast majority of them were accidentally hybridized from wild species, and then those early unstable forms were brought into a symbiosis with humans and allowed us to, you know, do everything that we did up until like 1700, which was like such a huge transformation from what had happened before. And yeah, I wonder, like, I'm very curious about the potential of things like CRISPR to move one gene at a time, but a genome and an organism isn't just a bag of genes. There's so much more going on that we're only just starting to get a sense of what it is. And maybe it is so chaotic and complex that we never will be able to just calculate it like a machine. It's never going to be completely predictable.
Maybe to use an analogy that might apply, I'm not sure, but if you think of the genes, because now we're messing with genomics, right? But it might be comparable to messing with, if you got like a computer, that you are messing with the operating system. So you can change, and that has huge consequences for how the computer functions, right? Because the operating system and all the software that's running on it, that basically defines how the computer behaves. But you're not really messing with the hardware around it. I mean, it's a faulty analogy, because of course if it was a better analogy, then the software would encode the hardware, because that's what we get with organisms, right? You get the DNA encodes the protein products, the whole machinery of cells.
There are some people that are expanding the number of DNA bases and the number of amino acids that can be encoded, and like the size of the codons. Instead of just three bases, I think they've jumped it up to four. There's proof of principle in like bacteria that you can do this kind of stuff. And I mean, that makes me wonder as well, do you think there's a possibility that there is non-DNA based life on Earth that we haven't detected because it's so small and rare and it doesn't grow in a petri dish easily?
Oh, yeah, don't get me tempted. I love to speculate, right? One video I'm working towards, and it's a slow process because I do a lot of thinking and philosophizing and reading literature or reading things on the internet. But one thing I was thinking about is that the way that life started on Earth was actually facilitated by minerals. Because minerals, too, they can encode information, right? The only problem with minerals is that they're very static. You cannot dissolve. I mean, if you dissolve the mineral, then it's the whole system falls apart, right?
But the
This is why
surfaces can catalyze
the
reactions in
surfaces,
interesting ways.
exactly. Now, if you kind of stuck to that, then maybe there's some way for life to still exist in a crystal form. And this has been a topic of science fiction. You see it regularly on Star Trek, right? Is they found this crystalline form, and they talk about how they can observe these very intricate patterns in the crystalline structure, and then they conclude, oh, it's alive, but we didn't realize it was alive. But now that we're looking specifically at this, then all of a sudden they realized, okay, so you can have a life form that is just crystalline, and it's basically if you can sequester information, if you can duplicate it, if you can, spread it around and then create more of it, create further structures. Yeah, maybe there's something, some crystalline life going on that we're completely unaware of.
Because, like,
Maybe
now that we've
in
used genomics to
mantle.
survey the environment for bacteria and viruses, we realize there's all of these species where there's just one cell here, one cell there, and they don't like growing in petri dishes. So we never realized they were there until we could really carefully look for their DNA. But what if there's
Oh,
other
that is right.
microbes out there that don't use DNA? We'd be blind to them.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's true, but how would that work, right?
Well, I mean,
I mean,
this gets to
there's
the
the
to
PNAs.
it
There's
gets to the broader
PNA.
idea of life on other planets as well too. Like we wouldn't necessarily recognize it if it was biochemically different to what we're used to.
Oh, this is also a very, very vexing question for me. Will it still be DNA based, right? Is DNA the best way? And especially the codons that are, the 23 amino acids that we use for our biochemistry, are those maybe the optimal ones? And on another planet, they will arrive at the same set, the same kinds of biomolecules to create life. Will it still be DNA and protein and peptides and all of that? This is really vexing because you can imagine different. I mean, there's so many different amino acids than just the 23 that we use for life. Or was it 23? I'm not sure about the number,
I
but
think
I think
it's
there are like hundreds.
20. I think it's 20, but there's a couple of odd ones that are important.
I think it was 20 or 23, right? But there are like hundreds of different kinds of amino acids that we're not using. So are these not useful enough? Is our genetic code optimized for those specific ones?
You've almost got an ecosystem of chemical functions amongst all of the amino acids. And once you have an amino acid that does a particular job well enough, this is the negatively charged amino acid, there's less pressure to evolve other negatively charged amino acids because one already is working perfectly fine. I suspect that pattern extends all the way down to our basic biochemistry.
Yes, and I think when life was still, or bef I mean when we only had prebiotic chemistry on life, I think what the first thing that happens, and as far as I understood from abiogenesis research, is that maybe life didn't even start out as cellular. Maybe it was a whole ecosystem of chemicals that we had, right? All kinds of chemicals interacting with each other, helping each other out. Okay. And then at a certain moment, cell membranes became a nifty thing to concentrate those. But there was already maybe a whole ecosystem of just chemicals interacting with each other. And they kind of agreed on this system of DNA, or in any case of peptides, to get things working. And then those were eventually compartmentalized into cellular structures, and then later on into multicellular organisms.
Do
But
you think the rare
it's
earth hypothesis is becoming stronger now that we're getting more exoplanet data? Like we're looking at planet systems all over the world, all over the galaxy, and we're starting to realize that our whole solar system is kind of strange.
It is. I'm more and more leaning towards a relatively rare earth concept. I mean, might not be as dire as the proponents of the rare earth hypothesis propose, but I mean, there's this paradox, right? There's the someone, I think it was the Cool Worlds Lab. It's a YouTube channel associated with a research institute at a university. I forgot the name of the primary investigator, but he talks about the red sky paradox, because red dwarfs, the M-class stars, they're so much more numerous than our particular star, the sun, which is a yellow dwarf,
And they're
a
very long
G-type
lived
star.
as well, too.
And they're very long-lived. So statistically, if they're equally, if you have habitable zones around those stars, which you will have, then why did we find ourselves under the sky of a yellow star? Statistically, I mean, it sounds like we won the lottery, because it's maybe one out of 1,000, or maybe even 10,000, right, that we happen to find ourselves. So, but now the more that I learn about M-class stars, the red dwarfs, not only I'm starting to lean towards that they might not be that good for life. I mean, we already knew that they're very active in their, especially in their early stellar youth. They're very violent. They emit a lot of radiation. There are a lot of flares when they're still young, which will damage, the atmospheres of any inner planets. But then, even if it calms down, then the radiation typically coming from those stars. I read a paper by and his colleagues that talked about that kind of radiation is worse at breaking down carbon monoxide. So that means that these planets might never become aerobic, because the amount of carbon monoxide is just toxic for any kinds of aerobic life that tries to evolve there. So it might be microbial. You might have microbial life around red dwarf stars, but it will never become. You will never get a Cambrian explosion, because the level of oxygen, even if it rises, there's also so much carbon monoxide that is not being broken down by the radiation of this star. So you will never get complicated or interesting life. I think they talk about the habitable zone for complex life. So that kind of excludes those kinds of stars. Now there's a middle class of stars, the K-type dwarfs, which are orange dwarfs. You can call them orange dwarfs. They're kind of in between the yellow dwarf that we have and the red dwarfs. And that might be actually more suitable for life, even than our yellow star. But maybe there's some quirk about those, right? So the more, and also the more, when I think about how life did not evolve on Mars, because it's too small, and it couldn't hold on to an atmosphere, because it lost its magnetosphere, and it lost a magnetic field to shield the atmosphere. And then if you look at Venus, it's just a tad too close to the sun. It had this runaway greenhouse effect. I mean, I've been speculating on my channel about the old idea of life on Jupiter, in the atmosphere of Jupiter, right? But I honestly don't think there's probably not life on Jupiter, if I have to be realistic, right? We probably would have seen signs of it. So I'm getting more and more pessimistic, and I'm starting to narrow it down more and more to, exactly, something has to be exactly like the Earth, and maybe we even need a moon.
Well,
And
I was going to bring up, can I run past you my wild theory for why the Earth system may have been a really rare example of where you can form complex, like multicellular life. So this is based on the observation that the records we have on Earth show signs of bacterial life appearing practically as soon as the planet cooled down. Like it happened so fast. And my theory is that that kind of bacterial level complexity life is very, very easy to form when you've got the suitable chemical and temperature conditions. But what's really unique about Earth is that it was a twin planet system that had this glancing collision. So what I think probably happened is that archaea and bacteria, these two very different forms of single-celled life, one of them formed on Earth and one of them formed on Theia. And during that collision, we ended up with both of them put together in the same biosphere. And if you know your evolutionary history, they now think that an Archaean cell absorbed a bacterial cell that became the mitochondria, and that combination made it possible to build complex cells like protozoans and then humans and plants.
Yes. That is interesting theory. I mean, we know that bacteria and archaea, they are related. So they come
but
from
they've
the
got
same...
really deep differences, like their membranes and their ribosomes. Yeah. Like there's these inexplicable, like they had some kind of separation.
I'm very much inclined to think about what I would like to call transpermia. Because, you know, there's this concept called panspermia, meaning that life is spread all over the universe somehow through, you know, bacteria floating in space or something.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to narrow that down to, I need to research this. I mean, maybe someone already talked about this, right? But you might get something like, you know, might get something like transpermia, meaning that would narrow down to just a transfer just within our solar system, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you had for a while Venus, Earth, and Mars, they're both... were equal when it comes to their planetary environments. They were all three able to sustain an atmosphere, liquid water. And so it's likely then, given how quickly life evolved on Earth, the same probably happened on Venus and Mars. And then there was, of course, there are these meteoric impacts that happened, especially in the beginning of the Earth.
And they eject material from the crust. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So there might have been some cross-pollination between Mars, Venus, and Earth. We don't know. But this is what I would like. I mean, it's been speculated. This is not a new idea by me, right? But what is maybe new that I would like to call that transpermia, to kind of distinguish it from panspermia, which goes a bit maybe too far to think that panspermia, I mean, life is spread through interstellar space and is all over the galaxy that way. I think it's more likely that, likely that life is spread within the inner planets even, right?
Yeah. And that's another rare factor for the Drake equation of having multiple habitable planets around the one sun.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. You've got to make a video on that. There you go.
I will. I will also introduce another concept that I will call cisspermia, which, hear me out, right? But it might be, because what happened before Theia, Earth was maybe already suitable for life, and maybe life already developed in the period before the collision with Theia that created the moon, which basically made Earth unlivable, right? It was becoming a magma ball again. But any life that developed before that event might have been floating around in space on these little rocks, right? Asteroids, meteors, debris. And then slowly over time, they were reintroduced to the Earth, and then life could pick up again.
Yeah.
So maybe life goes even further back than the Theia events, which might explain, because Luca is the video I did on the last universal common ancestor for, you know, all life on Earth, including archaea and bacteria. It's really close to, it's almost too close to call, right? They use some sophisticated techniques to date the genome. And it's like you have just, I mean, you have like 100 million years to get Luca, which is already quite sophisticated on the level of a bacteria.
Yeah.
I mean, 100 million years is a long time, but to go from prebiotic chemistry to cellular to then something like a bacteria over 100 million years, I don't know.
It reminds me of another theory I saw that, assuming the Big Bang model is correct, there would have been a Goldilocks period for life during the early expansion. There would have been a window of time when the temperatures and the density of different materials was such that it could have been conducive to life, and that if you look at some of the measures of genome complexity and project it back, it actually goes back all the way to that presumed 14 billion years ago rather than just the 4 billion for our planet. So that it's a possible mechanism for like universal panspermia of the really simple, like self-replicating elements that would have come before the first bacterial-like cell. I don't know. It's a big stretch when you're
Yeah,
taking things that
it
far.
is. But it's interesting to think about, right? I mean, it's going back and forth, because the conventional view is that in the early universe, there were not enough, raw materials in the form of heavy elements, because they were still being formed in these massive stars that turned supernova. So you needed time to get enough ingredients to be able to create life, and especially things like iron, which is more important than you'd think. But also just phosphor, the CH, NaOPs, NOPS, CHOPS, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphor, and sulfur. You need at least those, but also heavy elements like iron, like copper, like zinc. Those are used by life, as a quest of life, and they're a huge advantage because of the, what
Do
they
you think
offer
that do you
to.
think there might be other habitable zones that we're overlooking? So like the upper atmosphere of Venus has some hints that there could be
Oh yeah.
microbes there.
Yeah, I'm yeah.
And there's deep hot biospheres as well that could be like far below the crust of bodies that are quite cold on the surface. And like
I
we can
mean,
barely measure them here on Earth with all of our equipment right at our fingertips. So do you have any hope that we're going to like drill into, I don't know, even the
Well,
moon has a warm zone closer to its core.
yeah. I mean, I like to think about it, but I'm also skeptical. I might be a bit, provincial in that sense, because my principal attitude is that the kind of life that we know is the only kind of life we know for certain can exist. Now, that doesn't mean that we cannot have other kinds of life, but it's all very much up in the air. So when you think about life elsewhere, then the most certain path is to imagine it along our lines. So at our range of temperatures, being water soluble and all of those things. But I've heard, and I've also entertained alternative ideas. Like there's some suggestion that there might be life on the methane oceans of Titan, right? Because it's so cold there that water ice basically forms the bedrock of oceans of methane that are it's so called that exists in liquid state. Now, methane could also serve as a solvent, but I mean, but my understanding is that it is also low energy. Now, energy, of course, it's all about gradients, of course, if you want to, it's all about gradients. So in principle, just because it's cold doesn't mean it cannot have life. But when you think about the amount of energy that is needed for complex multicellular life on Earth, which required the oxygen to unlock all that of energy, then maybe energy levels are a re restriction here as well. So I'm not keeping my hopes up for life on Titan. Now, there's another suggestion when you think about hotter life. There was this proposal by some scientists that there might be. There are many of these super Earths we find that likely have like a very thick hydrogen atmosphere, and so these are high pressure environments and also much hotter than Earth. But because of the pressure, water becomes liquid under those circumstances, even though it's many times over our boiling point,
And
right?
we already
On
see that here with extremophile bacteria in if they're in an area with high pressure, I think they can get up to 160 degrees Celsius.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So that is, I would more be interested, I would more lean to that possibility, right? But then it will probably not be very interesting life forms either. It'd probably just be microbial, because the advantage that we have on our modest little planet is we've got this tiny sliver of water. I mean, we think of the oceans as our oceans as really deep, but it's not a lot of water. Which is a huge advantage, because it unlocks the crust of the planet. It releases all of these useful minerals that we can use for ever more complex beings. So you will not have that on an ocean world, even if it's a temperate ocean world, right? If it's like a world that has oceans that are like 1,000 times more deeper than Earth oceans, that you will not have any chance of having ever, have any dry land at all, ever. And the disadvantage of that also is that at those depths, water becomes pressurized into a special kind of ice that is will that would envelop the whole crust. So
Yeah,
then you will
it
not get
doesn't
any.
float. It doesn't
Yeah,
float, so
no,
it gets
it
stuck down
doesn't
there.
float. it gets stuck down there. I mean, you might have floating ice shells as well, right? But the pressurized water at those depths become like solid. So this high pressure ice is will have kind of locking down all the minerals. And so again, I keep on thinking back of the Cambrian explosion and what was necessary for that. You know, the interaction with the continental shelf, the release of minerals, the rise of oxygen. You will not have that on ocean worlds, and you will not have them on Hycean worlds either. So yeah, there might be life might be everywhere in the universe, you know, crystalline, microbial, but for the kind of life that leads to humans, we might need to be as provincial as I'm now tending to think, is that, you know, you need an Earth. You need an Earth with a moon that will help stabilize its rotation. Maybe
and bump up the size of its core, like that glancing blow that just left the core behind.
Yeah,
that was a really unlikely event.
There was like a filtering that happened, right? A resorting of the whole, you know, lithosphere. So yeah, it's all of these serendipitous events that led to the Earth. I wouldn't say I'm a fan of the rare Earth hypothesis because I would like to be more optimistic. I would still like to, hold my hopes out for life on Jupiter, for life on Titan, for life maybe even on Mars and Venus still. But the Earth is so special, and also our whole solar system, the way that the major planets that were prevented from migrating inwards because of their distribution, right? We got Saturn pulling Jupiter back, so to prevent it to moving further inside and destroying all the inner planets. It might be very rare to have something like the Earth, and we still haven't found it. I mean, we have like an observation bias, of course, because the things that we are most easily observable are the ones that are, you know, close, tight orbits and relatively large. So we would tend to find planets around red dwarfs, around, you know, tend to find super Earths or giant planets, which are not in themselves very Earth-like. Might they have their own kind of life? I don't know.
Do you think it's more interesting to live in a universe that's full of complex life, or that we're it's just life on Earth and nothing else? Which of those is more exciting to you?
You're asking the wrong person, because I'm really biased. I mean, if it was up to me, there would be life everywhere. There would be life on Mars. There would be life on Jupiter, right? I would love to have a lot of life all over the universe. But maybe if Earth is rare, that might also be interesting, because then we can spread our kind of life all over the galaxy, right?
Well, question about the engineerability of life.
Yes,
do you think that, particularly with human assistance, that life can be adapted to, particularly complex life can survive and maybe even transform other planets?
I mean, this is a condition for space colonization, because our kind of life is not very good at surviving by its very nature outside of our little biosphere. So we need, I mean, even just crossing the distances to another planet, we might be forced to prolong our age so we can actually, you know, witness the arrival at a nearby system.
Could I make an analogy?
Yeah.
So when life first evolved, it was very dependent on living in water or in like sediments, and the surface of dry land was extremely hostile for unicellular, simple life for many reasons. And it was only when life became more complicated and multicellular that it really got going on the surface of the land, that it overcome all of those, hostile conditions, the UV light, the drying out, harder to move around, all of those issues. And I wonder if there's an analogy with life getting into space, that it needs a higher level of complexity to survive the even harsher conditions in space.
Yes.
But all sorts of, cooperation and symbiosis might make that possible in the future.
Yeah. Maybe life does need a sapient species able to do genomics to be able to transcend to the next level. Because I don't think life on its own would be able to colonize space. I find it hard. I mean, just to escape the atmosphere, and be in the vacuum. And yeah, sure. I mean, tardigrades and bacteria, they can survive on surfaces, right? Or
And
maybe
there's
just
fungi growing
pictures.
on the outside of the ISS, I think I saw a report.
Yeah, I think those were lichens. I think it was an or wasn't that an experiment I did with lichens? Yeah.
I
I
can
mean, we
just
could
imagine someone
probably.
having to go out there and scrape the lichen off the hull of their
Yes.
ship. Space
Now,
barnacles.
I'm also a bit of a radical because, we all know, we probably most of us know that NASA has this policy not to contaminate other worlds with our kinds of life. But I'm more of the move over microbe league. It's like,
You've had
okay,
4 billion years if you haven't done it yet.
get out of here. Because I would love to just start with just lichens and nematodes and very simple hardy life forms from Earth, maybe even genetically engineered. I mean, we'll never become like Earth, right? But it become a close second if we have lichens thriving on Mars, maybe even making it more viable for other kinds of life by introducing more, doing something with the atmosphere. That would be interesting in itself, like having like a very, very simple constrained kind of life on something like Mars. That would be still, I would love to see that happen.
I reckon Venus is the better candidate, even though it's more hellish now. It's closer and it's actually got an atmosphere. You just need to take some elements out of the atmosphere rather than creating a whole atmosphere from scratch.
Well, the just is doing a lot of legwork here. I mean, it is a huge enterprise, and there's so much carbon
Well,
dioxide.
look at how photosynthetic organisms drew all of that methane and carbon out of our
Sure.
atmosphere.
Oh
So
yeah.
there's a
Oh
precedence
yeah.
there.
If you wait 1 million years, yeah, maybe. I mean, it could start as, I mean, we could gen if it's if there's not life there already, right? We could engineer floating life, like little balloons that float around. We could even do the same with Jupiter, right? We can just engineer these tiny little floating plants, like little balloons that can, adjust their buoyancy to kind of navigate the atmosphere. And, we could start there. We can start in our, forget about the galaxy. We can start to spread our kind of life inside our solar system. And that in itself, even if it takes millions of years, maybe humanity even doesn't live to see it. That's still worth it, right? I mean, for life is so fantastic, I think, and it's just spreading it around, even if it just evolves, never be evolves beyond a certain stage. Just having a Venus atmosphere filled with little tiny little balloons, or maybe huge balloons, you never know how big these things, but yeah, how big these structures that can become the size of cities, even. Now, that would be interesting. And then, just as I speculate in my video on life on Jupiter, these giant creatures that float in the atmosphere, they become themselves a substrate for other kinds of life that are more, like earthbound, so to speak, that are
Yeah, I watched
more.
that video. It's great. Like you outline how a whole ecosystem of different forms could form complementary to each other.
So I think life on a gas planet, or even just in on a planet with an unlivable surface, is doable, but I don't think it can initiate. I mean, I speculate on how it could initiate on Jupiter. I mean, it's based on the work by Carl Sagan and his colleague Salpeter. But yeah, I kind of imagine you can these little tiny little droplets floating this steam floating in the atmosphere, and they become their tiny little laboratories for life. I mean, it's
It's worth pointing
conceivable.
out to the listeners too that this isn't so far-fetched. Recently, surveys of the clouds on Earth has shown that they have a thriving and dynamic microbial community that actually help create the clouds. They're part of the weather system that is, it's another variable to throw into that complicated problem.
Oh, what? That is amazing, actually. So that even more underlines how the whole biosphere is a whole system that it's somehow engineers its own environment, right? It creates the clouds, it sequesters minerals, it's actually amazing. And what is interesting also, they think that life on land actually was initiated by fungi. Fungi just they colonized first, and they enabled, photosynthetic life to follow, like plant life eventually, right? And this makes sense why you still have something like lichens. They're like a symbiosis between fungi and algae. And it's likely that life, that fungi are still playing a huge role in our biosphere by because of their role, you know, aiding plants, you know, the sequestering of the binding of nitrogen, the fixation of nitrogen. And like a whole forest could be like a living, one living organism just because of the fungi that lives in the bottom. It's interconnected. It's connecting all the different elements, all the plants, in any case, all the trees are interconnected in this huge network. And this is my problem with, I mean, if you want to settle Mars, you want to think about bringing those mycorrhiza fungi along. And one of my colleagues actually had an interesting talk is that, you know, as Polynesians spread through the South Pacific, they brought with them a lot of plant material, like tubers, mm-hmm. so they can grow their crops wherever they landed. They were very well prepared. They thought about this, right? It's almost like they knew what they were. Well, they probably knew what they were doing because they brought all these things to all the different islands to basically settle those new lands.
It's very similar to leaf cutter ants. When a queen flies out to form a new nest, she has a little pocket on her side where the fungus that lives in the leaf cutting ant gardens.
Yeah.
She takes a little sample of that with her to start the new colony.
Yes. Exactly, because you need the fungi, and a lot of these fungi are specific to certain plants. So, and I asked them when they were holding the talk, I mean, is it conceivable that just a tiny amount of dirt that was still sticking to some of these roots or tubers or seeds that they were bringing along, or just anywhere in their equipment, right? Just these tiny little spores that were crucial when they wanted to grow their crops in their new environment, right? So that is important if you want to. I mean, that movie, what is it called, The Martian, right? Where he poos on the soil and then he mixes the soil with his poo and then he can grow potatoes. I mean, you're missing the mycorrhiza there. I mean, what about the mycorrhiza? I mean, forget, I mean, not even, let's just forget about the perchlorate. The soil of Mars is like extremely toxic to life. It might be even a different kind of life that is completely alien to us. Because, you know, remember the Viking experiments where they inundated, you know, soil samples with, you know, a fertile soup of organic materials, and something seemed to be happening. Some of the tests were positive, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a long-standing mystery that it's kind of been swept under the rug.
But it turns out these perchlorates, they are very aggressive. They break down organic materials right away. So that's why you cannot just, you need to solve the perchlorate problem first on Mars. Probably even before you start planting lichens there.
Yeah.
But maybe you can even adjust lichens beforehand using genomics to, or any kind of plant to be able to deal with, or maybe even specifically target the perchlorates to break them down to you know, because life also had to adapt to something as mundane, we think now, as oxygen.
Oh, oxygen's horrible.
Yeah.
Oxygen is so horrible. It's amazing, but it's a huge hazard to all of the machinery of life that evolved in an environment with no oxygen.
Exactly. So, but then again, that also makes, this is to hark back on the point that in the early, you know, during the biogenesis events and the early life, it's probably best that there was not so much oxygen, right? Because that would have maybe just destroyed any attempt to create life. So the same, if you want to transplant life to Mars, you would need to do something about the perchlorates, which is basically as aggressive as oxygen, except that it's in the soil.
Mm.
Yeah, but...
Now, we've been going for more than an hour, so we should probably wrap it up. Do you want to tell people more about where they can find your work and, you know, check out all the amazing things that you've been doing?
Oh, yeah, thank you. Yeah, well, my YouTube channel is called Phrenotopia, which is, you know, the Phreno of phrenology. It basically means mindscape. Mm-hmm. I struggled very hard to find the unique name, but it means that I would like to imagine. It's the land of imagination. So Phrenotopia, so Phrenotopia.
Brilliant.
And this is my hub of speculative anything, but mostly evolution.
Mm. Well, I thoroughly recommend people go and check that out. And Fedor, thank you very much for taking the time to have a chat.
Yeah, and thank you very much for having me. It has been a delight.
The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me, or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.